Are you ready to grow your business, build wealth, and spark transformation in the South Suburbs of Chicago? Visit southlanddevelopment.org today and sign up for our newsletter to stay connected, get resources, and be the first to hear about the Achieve Summit, where entrepreneurs, developers, investors, and changemakers come together to ignite growth and opportunity. Don't just watch change happen, be a part of it. Join the movement at southlanddevelopment.org and start building your legacy today. In this episode, Bitcoin lawyer and expert Joe Colasari joins me to unpack the explosion of digital currencies and the global shift some are calling the Great Reset. More importantly, we dive into how entrepreneurs and real estate developers can leverage Bitcoin and stablecoins right now to unlock capital, speed, and new market access. If you're an entrepreneur or a real estate developer, understanding stablecoins and digital currencies could be your new competitive advantage. So welcome to our podcast. The first million is always the hardest. Really excited to have you, Joe. And just for everybody who's listening and watching, give us your name. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Yeah, thanks, Bill, for having me on. Joe Colasari. I am a commercial litigator with the law firm of Amundsen Davis, based there out of Chicago. It's a Midwest firm with numerous offices, and we do full-service law firm. I have a practice that focuses on commercial litigation generally, but also I have a particular sub-practice in the digital assets, cryptocurrency, fintech, blockchain practice group. So I've been growing that practice for years. I've had a lot of success in this real nascent field, and happy to chat with you about it today.
Yeah, well, that's exciting, and it's different and interesting. You know, as a commercial litigator, you know, you don't think of Bitcoin as being an area of expertise, but it has become. And when did that kind of transition go from this is kind of an interest of mine to, hey, there's a business out of actually representing cases and people that need to just issues with digital currency?
Yeah, well, so I was the younger associate at the time in the law firm when these stuff started getting, you know, really going, and people say, hey, this is some weird cryptocurrency thing. It's like these hackers and eccentric cypherpunks are experimenting with it. Send it to the young associate to handle the file when it comes in the door, because it wasn't a big profile thing. And this is, you know, 2014, 2015.
Yeah.
So I had some of those early cases where we were having to explain to judges who at the time weren't even using email, you know, here's what right. digital assets are, here's how they work, here's what a blockchain is, and sort of, you know, making those early connections, seizing the opportunity in a field where the more senior partners weren't really interested. They kind of brushed it off as sort of a passing fad. Was great for me. And one client, you know, and you get a good result for them, that can lead to two or three clients, because we live in a referral type environment where people, based on trust, say, hey, this guy got a good result for me. So by 2016, 2017, there was an influx. You know, crypto was finally coming onto the main stage. It was being featured regularly on CNBC. A lot of entrepreneurs were coming out and saying, I want to build mining farms where we mine for Bitcoin. I want to start an ICO where we launch a token. I want to start a business that's focused on digital asset custodies. And if you were one of the few attorneys in the space that not only understood the law, but understood the actual discipline of cryptocurrency and digital assets, you could speak their language, right? You had that shared bond where they didn't have to explain to a regular commercial litigator, here's how the technology works.
Yep.
So once I realized that, okay, this is fascinating to me from a technological perspective, but also I can marry it with my legal acumen, it was a perfect marriage at that point for where I was in my career. And honestly, the amount of companies that just exploded through booms and busts, but they're always coming back stronger, was really a blessing. I mean, we have now major Bitcoin miners that have massive infrastructure and power agreements, and they're working with municipalities and working with power companies to try to mine Bitcoin. And we have smaller shops that, you know, the average guy that's just setting up a mining farm, and you know, we can provide service for them too. And then, as you know, just to wrap up here, in the field, right, because it's the Wild West, because the regulations are always changing, because the government policy shifts from administration to administration, there's a lot of people playing fast and loose with the rules. Yeah. There's a lot of fraud going on. And in my world for litigation, you know, that's where we come in and try to clean up the mess.
Well, it's interesting, too, with things like fraud, because that's where you really start to get into this mix between I'm representing you to get you the best deal, but I'm also developing policy, because everything we're doing is so brand new
right.
that just the application of, you know, I'm going to represent you almost in and of itself becomes a policy conversation.
100%. Because if you're representing clients, right, and you set forth a legal policy or a precedent for your law firm, you would not be doing a service for them as a lawyer if I say, well, I'm going to represent this client and take this position legally. Right. And then now another client walks in the door and I have to take a completely contrary position, right? So you kind of have to make these broader macro discussions of what will Joe's firm have as a public policy with respect to this area of law. Because the worst thing that can happen to you is you argue something in front of a judge and then your opponent cites something where you made the exact opposite argument, right? Yeah. There's a famous Abraham Lincoln quote where he's representing two different clients. One in the morning, he argues one point of law, and he argues the exact same opposite point of law in the afternoon. The judge asks him, well, Mr. Lincoln, which one is it? What you said this morning or the afternoon? He says, well, clearly it's the one right now, Judge.
Clearly it's that one. Well, it's fascinating, too, just in terms of your own career development. And this is a note for those who are younger and thinking about this. You took an opportunity that could have been a dead end, right?
Absolutely.
It could have just been extra work and not be meaningful. And you actually were able to leverage that into a position within your organization that you carved out. And I had a similar experience when I was with Fragrie Drinker. I did a lot of opportunity zone work, which was very early in 2018.
Right.
And it was the same sort of thing. You know?
Yeah, I think it recurs throughout history, right?
Yeah.
If you're a younger person, right, you kind of want to go where the energy's at, what's fast moving, what's exciting, what field is there. You know, it goes back to even the people that were in the old country and moved over here, you know, Italian immigrants, right? We came here because there was opportunity, because it was growing, because there's excitement, because there's something new. Right now, there's tons of fields, like from AI and quantum and different fields for young people that, you know, if I were giving advice to somebody that was trying to get started out, it's like, go where the energy's at. Go where there's growth, right? That's where you want to sort of focus your efforts.
That's good. In general, the way to evaluate where to be within an organization is, where do they make the most money within that firm?
Mm-hmm.
So you were in litigation.
Yes.
Everybody's making money. It's basically, if you're a lawyer, you basically do intellectual property, you do litigation. There's almost like nothing else anymore, it feels
right.
like. But you found a niche within litigation.
Yes.
I want you to do a favor for all of us, which is just kind of outline the industry a little bit. Because you got engaged pretty early on, you know, 2014, which, by the way, by 2014, judges should be using email. I'm sure there were a few that weren't, but I—
Believe it or not, there were judges using fax machines in 2014.
Well, the fax, I can't fully justify it, but I do understand
it. In 2014, 2015, even 2016, you go over the Daily Center here in Chicago, they were using carbon copy, carbon paper.
they were doing mimeographs, you know, basically.
Yeah, carbon paper. I mean, it was incredible.
That's funny. Well, I want you to kind of take us through a high-level explanation of, like, Bitcoin versus stablecoins versus, you know, DeFi and all the different elements, just to make sure that we frame for the listeners and viewers the conversation that we want to have.
Okay, I'm gonna start very basic, because what you just asked me, I've studied probably 10,000 hours of it, so I'm gonna make it real simple for people, because that's what I try to do as a litigator. So the essential task of what Bitcoin is trying to accomplish is trying to create a shared ledger. Okay, think of it, if it's easier, like an Excel sheet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, where Bo has X amount of Bitcoin here, Joe has X amount of Bitcoin here, and if we want to swap, that ledger's updated in real time. If we want to say, I want to give you a Bitcoin and take a Bitcoin, that ledger is updated.
Yep.
Now, the problem is that who's going to maintain the ledger? Okay. Who actually is the one who is
responsible?
And not only who's responsible, how do we make sure that ledger doesn't get hacked? So what Bitcoin does, and it's really a beautiful design, even if you think it's a terrible investment, I encourage you just to explore it, because what it did is it found a way, again, through trying to overcome issues of distrust, to have collective understanding of what a shared distribution of knowledge and value is, okay? And the way they did that, they created something called Nakamoto consensus. It's a proof of work mining. We basically say, we're going to have a operating system where all of these nodes, they all keep an identical copy of the ledger, okay? And the nodes are constantly communicating and broadcasting, and without getting too technical, they're trying to say, how do we verify that the ledger is correct?
Mm-hmm.
So I run a node, right? It's basically just a tiny little computer at my house. And what it is doing in real time is validating every transaction, every single thing from, you know, you and I sending Bitcoin back and forth, to me sending it to somebody in China, to me sending it to an exchange.
Right.
It has every transaction since the history of Bitcoin. So when you hear the frame blockchain, what you're basically talking about is that ledger.
That is the blockchain.
Continually getting updated, really every 10 minutes, roughly. That's a block. Okay. So a new block will have a series of, you know, various transactions in it, and it will update it. So how do you secure that? Okay. Because it's a digital good. What they try to do is they tried through the design of Bitcoin, they try to say there's these blocks that are validating all of the transactions, mm-hmm. but underpinning it, there are miners. And the miners are providing, in broad sense, security for the network. They are the ones discovering which is a genuine block for the next sequence. What are they doing? It's very simple. They're taking huge amounts of computing and they're trying to solve a puzzle.
Yeah.
Think of it like a giant Sudoku puzzle, yeah. right? They're putting all this computing, all this hash power, they're investing huge amounts of electricity, and they're trying to find the hash. And if a Bitcoin miner finds the block,
yeah.
he gets to broadcast what transactions go into that. So all of these nodes and miners are working together.
It's like
in
naming
this,
a star almost.
Yeah, 100%. Exactly. Yeah. That's a great analogy. They're trying to work together to share and update and protect, most importantly, to protect this digital ledger. And the reason there's power behind it is because to actually try to attack this, to hack it, okay, you have to devote massive amounts of electricity, massive amounts of computing, and it's very challenging for anybody to overcome that. I mean, to give you an idea of the size and scope and scale, by some estimates, to recreate the infrastructure behind the Bitcoin blockchain, not the asset, but just the blockchain, you're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars worth of real physical world infrastructure. Nobody can do that in short order without it, you know, raising a lot of alarms, and it would be on people's radar.
You know, it's interesting in this whole conversation we're having about future technology, whether it be AI, robotics, and all of that. All of it goes back to some really old school technology,
yeah. right?
Infrastructure, water, power, all of these things actually matter so tremendously that we forget that's what's powering a lot of what it is that we're doing.
Well, that's the beauty of Bitcoin people don't, I think, initially grasp. So with respect to Bitcoin, right, you may say, how is it that a ledger entry, Joe, is worth roughly $100,000? How does that make sense? And the reason is because I can prove cryptographically that ledger entry is unique, okay, that it's one of a kind. And how do I know it's secure? Because if I have an email or a file on your computer, you know as well as I do, you can copy that file a million times over, yep. right? You can duplicate it. What Bitcoin figured out how to do is, how do we make a digital good scarce? And the way you make a digital good scarce is you marry it to the physical world infrastructure. Mm-hmm. You basically say it is protected by this massive amount of electricity and computing power, so no one can duplicate it. So someone can prove that this Bitcoin is unique, it has a unique signature, and you can't just, you know, copy it at will.
Yeah, and I'm sure it exists, but I have never seen it. The direct connection between the investment level required in the infrastructure and the actual value of Bitcoin.
Oh yes,
because
cost to mine.
Yeah, but there's different components to the value of the Bitcoin, because mm-hmm. the cost of mine is not the only component.
Right.
There are other components to it.
Like any valuation, right? When we're talking about a company, there's a million. I studied economics in university, and there's a million different ways to value something, right? What is subject? I mean, even in simple corporate disputes, we have to hire appraisers, right? And there's replacement cost value. There's yep. all different actual exactly. cash value, like you have
comps, all that kind of
comps,
stuff.
Comps, you have to figure out how do we value this. So one of the ways, to your point though, of people valuing Bitcoin, they say, well, what is the cost to mine?
Yeah.
For a commercial miner, what does it cost in terms of physical infrastructure and electricity? And then you can look at the actual price and say, is that higher or lower? There are times where Bitcoin falls below the cost to mine, believe
yeah.
it or not, and times where it stays roughly, 20-30% above.
Well, I will say, and this is, we did another podcast that was about artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
And if there is, and I believe artificial intelligence is probably going to be a net positive more than it is a net negative, mm-hmm. but it's going to go through cycles. Sometimes it's going to be very negative.
Yes.
Other times it may be very positive. But if there is a safeguard, because I don't believe there's been enough, the one is that you can pull the plug.
Mm-hmm.
Because without electricity, you won't have to worry about a lot of these things. So if it really gets bad,
yeah.
that's going to be the only answer.
Right, right. But, I try to stay optimistic because I truly believe that, humanity can solve any problem in its way. Right. So I don't really buy into a lot of the real negative doomerish type ideas about AI. I think we're going to figure this out. I have faith in humanity that maybe it's going to be a rough process. Maybe there's going to be a lot of growing pains, but we're going to figure out what the place is for AI and places for Bitcoin and other digital assets.
Yeah.
It just takes time.
I share your optimism in the long run, mm-hmm. but what I and this is a plug, of course, go listen to the podcast. But what I will say is that – the period of transition, I think was going to be very rough.
Yes.
And has the potential to be catastrophic if not handled well. But I also think it won't be handled evenly. And it's interesting because as an economist and a person who works in this space, the kind of concept of a K-shaped economy, I know you get what that is.
Yes.
And your the phraseology that you have of what the silent depression for young people
right.
is in another form, a K-shaped experience of, you know, wage earners versus, you know, non-wage earners, asset earners. I think the same is going to be true for AI. There are going to be some populations who, because status is not tied only to money, will transition in how they do work and cooperate with one another faster. That will allow for all of the benefits of AI to dramatically outweigh the negative parts. But those who hold on to kind of an old world ethos of status being directly connected to productivity, money, and all those other things will fight till the bitter end to not give up that worldview, and that will cause all kinds of pain.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, but my broad strokes takeaway from that is that how is that different from other periods in history? Because it's a recurring theme, right?
It is a recurring
you
theme.
The only constant in our lives is change. Right? You have to be prepared for violent, in many ways, upheaval of the status quo. I mean, if you would go back, I think, you know, 20, 30 years or when we were growing up, the world looked totally different,
yeah.
right? Everything's changed. We walk around with devices and people are glued to them. I mean, you look at the stats about, you know, younger people when they're dating and the majority, how they're meeting their partners. It's like all online.
How they're not meeting.
Or how they're not meeting, right? I mean, everything is constantly changing and you have to be adaptable. I mean, especially for younger people that are listening to this and trying to figure out their way in the world. I mean, you have to think in bets. You have to think in probabilities. You have to think, I don't have perfect information. I don't know how AI is going to all play out.
Right.
But each and every day, based on this piece of information and a reasoned judgment, here's what I think is the best path forward for me. And the problem I think we have is that we have so many people that think, well, I'm going to do exactly what my parents did, or I'm going to do exactly what their parents did. It won't work
that way. But it never worked that way. And it's really interesting, you know, you actually, in the story that you've already told, is a story of adaptability,
mm-hmm.
right? So 2014-15, you're an associate, I'm assuming, you know, at a law firm, and you got this project, and what you decided is, you know what, I'm going to really invest in this.
Yeah.
I'm going to go learn what there is. I'm sure you bought some early Bitcoin.
Oh, yeah.
So back in 2014, you got actually, you could have actually made some money in Bitcoin.
I've done well on Bitcoin.
You know, but that level of investment to the possibility of change mm-hmm. actually repositioned you to be in a completely different sphere. I feel the same way. My nature is to be interested in that change, that kind of intellectual mm-hmm. curiosity, as opposed to shy away from it.
Well, I approached Bitcoin originally as a skeptic. I mean, and that's just how my mind works as a litigator. Like, I always try to do the devil's advocate, adversarial thinking. I try to think, like, how do I tear this thing apart?
Right.
And the moment where it clicked for me that I thought this is going to change the world is when I actually experimented with it. I didn't read an article about forecast a price. I bought it and I sent a transaction. And I would venture that the majority of people who even own Bitcoin, they bought it on an exchange or
they've never done anything.
They never actually experimented with it. They never sent it, which is like sending an email, which is just, I mean, it's wondrous if you actually just look from a technological, forget the investment case for a second. Just if you're messing around, right, and you could do this for, you know, $25, you could send, you know, a small amount of Bitcoin from wallet to wallet, on-chain, experiment with it, look how it works in the blockchain, approach it like a scientist. And I was doing that activity. I'm like, this is incredible. Like, there's nothing like this in the traditional finance world. You have to go through banks
yeah.
and intermediaries, and there's settlement, and then there's clawbacks and all these things that yeah. are totally different. And I'm like, this is gonna be really attractive to some people. It's going to change the world and how we think about possession and custody. And that was the point where I thought, okay, well, at a minimum, I have to explore this further.
Yeah.
This isn't an ad. It's just our experience. At the Southland Development Authority, we've spent the past 5 years growing our team. And time after time, we've turned to LinkedIn, not because we had to, but because it works. It's where we found people who share our mission, our energy, and our commitment to the community. For a small but growing organization like ours, it saved us both time and money and connected us with talent that we might never have found otherwise. If you're looking for the right people to help grow your business, I can tell you from experience, LinkedIn works.
You're listening to The First Million is Always the Hardest. We are now returning to the show.
Oh, it's interesting, and I want to Actually, when you brought that up, it triggered in my mind, going back to this idea about how different locations and cultures would deal with AI. You know, lots of times people don't get the benefit of traveling the world, but if you go to a lot of places that are developing nations, you'll see that they have completely different ways of doing all different types of transactions, mm-hmm. whether it's taking a phone call or sending money to one another, sometimes in ways that we think, oh, well, that's not super sophisticated. But yeah, there's 50 million people that are using that system, right? Transacting a lot of business on a flip phone,
right.
You know, in Africa. And things like AI and things like Bitcoin only facilitate the speed of their transactions. And they happen to be one of the few places in the world that's actually growing in population. All the natural things that you would have to actually start to see growth in places are happening in a lot of places that are less sophisticated financially than we are.
Yeah.
And all these sorts of systems actually facilitate their growth at a much faster pace.
I mean, stablecoins are growing exponentially in emerging markets because they don't have access to dollar-based bank accounts,
exactly.
Right? That's very exciting for them, and they're using it, to your point, in ways that we can't even fathom, which is, you know, because we have access to very sophisticated, you know, Zelles and Venmos and all these different payment infrastructures. They don't have any of that. Don't have any of that. So it's fascinating, you know, the necessity, the mother of invention, right? When you're in those situations where you have to be creative and be imaginative, that generally leads to a lot of very innovation, right? Like Einstein said, imagination is more important than knowledge in many respects. And to me, like, I think that when you look at like AI, people now, they know of it, they have general awareness of it. I mean, I talked to lawyers and they think, well, I wanted to write briefs or do legal research. I use it in some bizarre ways. Like I have done a mock cross-examination of an economist. Hmm. And you can do it in real time. I think your experiment with that episode you were telling me about, I can ask an economist, okay, I'm gonna pretend you're having this theory, you're offering this opinion at trial, and I'm gonna cross-examine you. In a real dialogue, and I did it as a mock draft before I actually went and cross-examined the economist, and it was remarkable because he said very similar things to what the actual witness ended up saying.
Right.
And I think a lot of lawyers aren't even thinking about the different applications that could be used for the technology.
I agree fully. And just investing, and I have a philosophical point, which is, you know, most of us need to find at least 2 hours a week just to study.
Yes.
Something, right? And 2 hours a week is not easy, but not impossible. But if you do that consistently, you know, consistency compounds, as they say, right? 2 hours a week over the course of 6 months, you really now know something in a very different way and can apply it, to your point, in ways that are probably not expected.
And it could be diverse study. I mean, I find it very difficult when I talk to even people in their 30s and 40s, and they look at school and education as a completed task.
Right.
It is so bizarre to me. Like,
That was training just to teach you how to go learn. That's all it was.
Right. And in many ways, a lot of it's out of date, to be honest. Yeah. Like if you went to, you know, university, you know, a decade or more ago, I mean, every field has evolved. I don't care what it, political science, sociology, hard sciences.
Yeah.
The amount of knowledge that we've accumulated is compounding and it's growing, and you have to constantly, I mean, as a lawyer, I have to take continuing legal education.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's case law that exists now that fundamentally changes what I was taught in law school.
Right.
How could I just ignore that and do my clients, you know, good service?
Well, you know, this whole issue of stablecoin that you brought up is one that I'm interested in. And one of the things that's happening, as I see it, is there's an effort afoot, and you've actually represented a bank who, in fact, established their own stablecoin.
Yes.
What is it that a bank thinks that they're solving by doing that?
Yeah. So it's a great question because I think let's just start for folks what a stablecoin is. And there's been recent federal legislation that's come through, the Genius Act, that is allowing this. It's making it so that, you know, U.S. regulated institutions and non-financial institutions can launch stablecoins. So what it is, let's go back to, we talked about Bitcoin, and to build off that, rather than it just be a ledger entry that's just not backed by anything, the idea of a stablecoin is we can have a ledger entry on Ethereum or Solana or one of these other blockchains that's sort of blockchains that came after Bitcoin.
Yep.
We can have that ledger entry represent something in the quote-unquote real world, okay? It can represent treasuries, effectively. So the idea behind a stablecoin is You don't really buy it for an investment use case. You're not investing in stable coins because you think it's going to go up like Bitcoin. You're buying it because you want a solid, stable peg to a dollar. So if I have 10,000 stable coins of various different types, there's several different brands, yep, effectively, then that will be equivalent to $10,000 USD. And I can rest assured that that $10,000 United States dollar, which I can move freely from peer to peer, I could send you in final settlement very quickly, $1,000, just like I would with a Zelle or Venmo. But the difference is that I have custody of it. Like it's in my possession. And then behind those tokens, a bank or other institution has the treasuries that back it. So why is this attractive? Well, there's a huge amount of people that don't have bank accounts. Right?
A lot of people.
Banked and underbanked. And if they carry cash mostly, and this is sort of the digital equivalent of cash.
Yep.
They're going to have, a wallet where they can control it. They control it real time. It will run 24/7, 365. You don't have to worry about bank holidays. You don't have to worry about any of that. And it's done in such a way so that we have a regulatory apparatus now that has oversight over it, that's going to ensure that it's not just fake cash, fake digital dollars that don't have cash behind it. And then for those people that are unbanked, they can actually have greater access to financial inclusion and be able to spend it. And in my view, it is a improvement upon a lot of the existing banking infrastructure. Mm-hmm. It doesn't solve every problem. It doesn't provide, in many cases, access to credit. And we know a lot of people, they're hand to mouth and they're living off credit cards. That's
desperately,
just desperately. But there are a lot of other people that say, listen, I don't want to mess with credit cards. I just want access to a stable cash equivalent in the digital world. And that is particularly attractive to emerging markets. Like part of the impetus for passing the Genius Act was that we want to drive demand for treasuries, right? Because we've got a ton of debt. So if you say that every stablecoin is backed by a treasury, then that's going to
theoretically should have a supply or demand issue.
So if you're somebody who has access, if you're in El Salvador or if you're in Zimbabwe or in places that don't have access to regulated banking services, you can hold stablecoins. You can pay each other on a peer-to-peer basis for relatively low cost, and you have access to the American dollar. Which we know that the dollar is sort of the global reserve currency. There's a lot
for
of
now, at least not going to work.
For now it is. But I mean, this is going to the idea is this would strengthen that argument, right? Yeah. That you have more and more global access to it. And why would I hold the Argentinian peso when I can hold the dollar? And as Americans,
and Argentinians don't,
and they don't, right? And if you've traveled abroad, right, there are a lot of places in the world where they would prefer dollars
absolutely
over their native currency.
Two things out of that conversation are interesting to me. One, and I'll tell a little bit of a story. I do regional economic development, and I'm an investor in VC and all that kind of stuff. A lot of times people underestimate why people don't go to banking, and they think it's just a poverty issue. It's actually much more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. And it ties directly into why at least one of the early benefits of Bitcoin was the anonymity, right? Part of this, right? So there is a whole world of people who are underbanked or unbanked, and it's not necessarily nefarious, like they're trying to do illegal stuff, but they have reasons that they don't want to have, all of their information.
Privacy. I mean, they want privacy.
They want privacy.
There's nothing wrong with wanting privacy, by the way.
Most of us want privacy,
right?
As much as we can, reasonably have. But like you said, that's a whole segment of a population, some of whom have a lot of money, actually, that are not in the banking system at all.
Right.
So all of the analysis that we do about the economic impact is actually not fully reflected by these underbanked folks. Right?
Correct.
So just giving a system that allows people to be banked and accounted for in some way has kind of an impact that goes far beyond just giving them access to a bank. It has an impact in terms of our level of information and knowledge, and I think that's really interesting. I think the other interesting part of it is when you were describing the role that a stablecoin potentially could play in at least the demand for the U.S. dollar, I almost think of it like there's this term that you would use if you are an investor. And let's say you got a bunch of stock and warrants because you were part of the operating team. Your company goes public, but you can't sell for a certain period of time. What they would do is they do this thing called short against the box, right? Where you essentially take options and you lock in the price at the market today, but you buy equal amounts of options that it goes up and that it goes down that allows you to essentially pull that cash out and start to use that money.
Correct.
And to a large extent, what you're describing that stablecoins does is a version of that slash a version of like ETF, you know, kind of a way of reflecting the market in this one other product that I can then access and use.
Correct. Yeah. And that's attractive for a lot of people, I think. And, you know, do I think it's going to change overnight? No. It's like any other technology. There's going to be periods of adoption where it grows. People have to get more comfortable with it. They have to get more comfortable with it. You got to have more retailers more comfortable with it. But I think it's coming. And I think that a lot of the non-traditional forms of payment are going to accelerate into the future. And the other thing that I think has held Bitcoin back as a medium of exchange is like paying for coffee and different things is that, you know, if I spend some of my Bitcoin that I've been holding for years now, if I go buy it at a Starbucks with it, that's a taxable event. Yeah. I got to pay capital gains tax on it, which, to be honest, I'm not going to deal with the headache of that. It's a huge deal. If you buy a stable coin, right, theoretically, you shouldn't have any cap gain. You shouldn't have any appreciation. It's exactly. Just a dollar. It's a simple transaction. So to me, it makes a lot more sense in the developed world and in the emerging markets to use stable coin. Yeah.
And when banks are issuing them, what do they think they get out of that process?
Well, I mean, you get the inflow of the treasuries, right? So the banks, and this is the big secret why they love this, right, is that banks make money on the assets under management, right? So if they're holding, you know, a couple $100 billion or more treasuries, they don't care where it is, where the customer is that holds the end product, the stablecoin, they're getting that interest. They're getting that T-bill. So, you know, whatever's backing it, they're going to pull in 3%. And relatively, it's very low cost to run these things. I mean, on the blockchain, there's some compliance costs and there's some transaction fees, but they're minimal compared to what they're yielding in the actual product of holding the assets. There's a company that issues a stablecoin called Tether, right? Mm-hmm. And by per capita, by employee, it was one of the most profitable companies in the world because they were holding hundreds of billions of dollars of treasuries that were earning,
with
you know,
three people worked there, right?
with very small amount of people. They were making more money per employee than Goldman Sachs because they're pulling 4% on hundreds of billions of dollars. Just think about the return on that with a very limited upside. So now, from the standpoint of all these banks getting in, they want that capital. They want that ability to capitalize on that.
How quickly are you seeing the stablecoin kind of underlying asset diversify from things like treasuries to something that, you know, I'm particularly interested in as a regional economic development? Like, can I start to do public-private partnerships, major projects where we're building, you know, $1 billion worth of real estate and leveraging stablecoin for that transaction?
Yeah. So early on, years ago, just to set the table here, there was a tremendous amount of confusion at how do we even treat these things. I mean, in the early days, they were arguing Bitcoin was a security rather than a commodity. There was a lot of ICOs, initial coin offerings, which were basically securities. The people saying, you know, why don't you invest in this company that puts bananas on a blockchain and buy the token and it'll appreciate. Now what we're moving towards is various bills in Congress, including the Clarity Act, which are supposed to provide a quick path to do what you're talking about doing, which is provide tokenized securities, tokenized commodities, let them come in a regulatory clear way, that's why it's called the Clarity Act, with what this thing is. Okay, the problem we've had for years is we had an administration that was very hostile to digital assets. I think they've evolved on both sides of the aisle. Both Democrats and Republicans have said, no, this isn't going away. It's not going to disappear.
I think that's going to say the evolution is a function of the fact that it's going to be here.
Yeah. I mean, even the Treasury Secretary right now, Scott Bessent, he was very critical of digital assets. And he just gave an interview recently saying, you know, I've evolved on that, which I think a lot of people have, right? That's generally the approach. And the question is, from here, how do we have a market that has consumer protections? How do we have it that's clear from a regulatory standpoint? And, you know, there's a lot of entrepreneurs, and I believe in letting entrepreneurs work their creative genius to bring products to market in a safe way. You know, it's always a balancing act. But, of course, you know, people like you should be able to launch these things and allow lots of mainstream investors to participate in a way. And obviously, there's no guarantee in an investment. But we have to figure out how to bring more people into the fold. And part of the problem we have right now, I think, going back to the K-shaped economy, is that there's really two sets of rules. I mean, one of the things I rail about all the time is the accredited investor rule, which are you familiar with that?
But for the benefit of everybody else, essentially, you have to have a certain amount of assets or make a certain amount of money over a consecutive period of time for you to be able to make an investment. And if you don't, you're not even able to make the investment at all.
Correct. So if you're a younger person starting out and you've identified the next great entrepreneurial opportunity, you want to put your hard-earned capital in, you are restricted in right. some ways from investing in that. And there's reasons for that. And the reason is because yeah. we don't think you're sophisticated enough as the accredited investor, right?
You have to have some experience is what they're arguing, which actually is reasonable, but yes. it's constraining in ways that I don't think they intended it to be constraining.
Exactly. And that's the key. So how do we fix that problem? And I think one of the things is what you're talking about. How can we tokenize these different ventures and efforts and get more people in a safe and responsible way? It's always the balancing act. And I think Clarity Act and some of the other bills that have been proposed in Congress do that.
Yeah.
So to answer your question succinctly, I think that that is coming with a new piece of legislation from Congress where we're going to be able to say definitively as a lawyer, I have a law here that says here's how it works and here's what I can tell you. Because before, what I would have to do is I'd have to analyze a whole bunch of decisions that are conflicting and give you sort of a reasoned opinion. Here's what I think you can do without being violative of the law. That's not fun for an entrepreneur, like right yeah. when you're trying to quantify risk.
It's too much risk.
It's too much risk.
I spent all my time, I mean, paying you, which I'm sure you are worth paying, but I spent all my time paying lawyers to protect me when, in fact, I needed the law to be clear.
Yes.
You know, what's interesting, I don't feel quite yet that both federal and state governments learned the lesson of the experience that we had, for example, with the internet, meaning that we did very little to support legislatively the development of the internet. And some of that was good because it gave freedom, but some of it was really bad because it meant that we didn't have any fail safes and things. And I don't have the sense that the lessons, good and bad, from that past experience are now being adopted in, you know, both Bitcoin or stablecoins
or AI
or yeah. any of this. And I just, someone who I think is probably closer to it than I am, am I wrong
no.
in my assessment?
You're exactly right. I mean, we have, and I think this is, I say this is in a nonpartisan way. I think we have a real problem in our Congress because they cannot tackle big issues, even sensible ones, which a lot of, there's, you know, broad spread consensus view on. It's just gridlock, and it's just, you know, we can't get anything through. I mean, the fact that it took us years to get a stablecoin bill through when the things like this were proposed 5-6 years ago, and
yeah.
all we're talking about is treasuries on a blockchain, right? We need to figure out a way to tackle these issues. And I'm not for overregulation. I'm not for underregulation. I'm for smart regulation. I think that you should have smart, tackled way to promote entrepreneurialism. And the problem is that most of the time that just gets completely lost in Congress. There's special interest groups that either want to yeah. box out competition or right. You know, in a protectionist type way, or there's people out there that want to overregulate and crush anything new that comes on the block. And you have to figure out a balance.
Your silent depression, as you were describing it, really encapsulates a lot of different things. But it really, I think, centers on this concept of wage earners versus asset earners.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing about those two categories is substantially different than it has been throughout history, right?
Right.
The people who've always made the most money in this world were asset earners.
You know? Correct.
And the people who were, you know, struggling day to day have typically been more wage earners. And very little that we've done has really helped move people from wage earners to asset earners. It kind of almost is self-perpetuating. In fact, I would actually make the argument we've done a lot to move asset earners to wage earners, and that we've made that group of asset earners even smaller.
Right. I mean, the way I look at it is I think that we have made it public policy that asset prices need to rise.
All the time. No matter
right.
what.
Right. I mean, you see a 10-20% decline in the stock market, which historically was garden variety, and you see shows that say, you know, turmoil in the markets on CNBC, people freaking out, people scared,
right.
Because our entire system is built on the stock market rising. You have pensions, you have, you know, tax receipts.
I mean, everything
is
funding schools.
Funding schools.
Everything.
And that's a problem because if you basically say we have to do whatever it takes to get asset prices to rise, what you're effectively doing is you're trying to disturb the natural cycle of things, which there's a boom bust economic cycle. Things grow, then they decline. And in when that reset, just like the changing of the seasons, there's opportunity, right? When things fall, you give younger people opportunity to buy houses and to buy stocks and to take risks, right? The problem I have is that we've gotten into a situation where we have normalized exorbitant, in my view, asset prices. The average, in this goes back to the silent depression, you know, you look at people's incomes, right? 20, 30 years ago, the average median worker, they could pick up real estate for three, four times their annual salary. Now it's 6 to 10, right? Yeah. We've normalized young people taking out huge amounts of debt without any realistic return on that investment in the form of college. We have normalized a whole generation of people in their late 20s, early 30s, living at home with their parents, right? Because they can't afford housing, because they can't get started in their career. We've normalized all these things that make it stock market cannot fail, but real wages aren't going to be able to rise. And you know, one of the things we sort of miss is that in this environment post-pandemic, there was a period for a couple of years where you actually saw people's real income rise.
Yeah, there was.
And now it's back flatlined.
Yeah.
And what are cost of living still trickling along, always compounding at 3%, right? So we have to figure out how do we create a growth that is not only just, you know, paper gains in stocks and assets, but how do we create growth that actually is inclusive for younger people? And this is particularly difficult because we have the blessing, and I say this with parents that are, you know, living, you know, my dad's in his 80s, right? Like, it's wonderful to have people living a lot longer, right? But those people have accumulated so much wealth and so many resources that they can basically spend a lot of them without any restrictions.
Yep.
And you got a lot of younger people that are just fighting to survive.
The exact opposite.
I can't tell you about how many times I hear stories about young professionals in their early 30s. They're married, they have two incomes, and they're barely making ends meet.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just stunning to me, you know, if you look back historically. And the problem is, like, if you're only focused on asset prices, that's not going to help those people because they don't have assets.
That's right. And it takes assets to get more assets, and it's a bit of a perverse situation. But it also brings us to, you know, this narrative that's in the market right now that those who do have assets and have accumulated a lot of them, the wealthiest of not just this nation but of the world, are moving in this direction of an asset reset. Mm-hmm. And you know, the great reset, you know, theory where, there is a need for a reset because, hey, there's a lot of debt and we need a mechanism to pay down that debt. But in the process of leveraging, whether it be stable coins or Bitcoin or anything else, to use that as a vehicle to pay down the treasuries and the actual debt that extended out there, you're going to depress prices substantially. Mm-hmm. Everyone's going to suffer in some degree, but those who have more assets are going to be left with something and can pick up the rest. I'm not saying I agree with this as a theory, mm-hmm. and that this is where things are going. But there are elements of it that feel real, just to the naked eye. And I'm curious kind of your take on that whole kind of great reset theory.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's start with the debt issue. The challenging aspect of the debt issue is that you don't have a whole lot of great options. You have the option of, okay, we're going to cut spending, which we know if you cut spending, that's going to hurt tens of millions of regular working people. We know a lot of people depend on government spending just to survive, right? And that's not really attractive. And in that environment where you cut spending, you're probably going to collapse asset prices, which is going to make things worse. And you're really not going to hurt the upper income, because the upper income are going to have access to credit and the ability to buy things on the cheap. You're going to probably hurt the working poor and in the moderate and modest households the most. So that doesn't seem particularly attractive, and it's not politically viable, right? Like
politically, it's not viable.
It's not viable at all. So we're not gonna cut spending or cut our way out of this problem with the debt. So then, what's the opposite? The opposite, if you push to the other direction, is what if we accelerate spending? You know, what if there's a theory in economic circles right now called running it hot. What if we run the economy hot, which right now, if you look at, you know, the deficit to GDP, we're running at like 6 to 7% deficit to GDP. We're blowing a lot of money into the economy right now, which if you're spending in a public sector deficit, that's a private sector surplus, right? Yep. So what does that do? That will keep inflation probably higher than it should be, closer to 3%, maybe than the target where they're supposed to be at 2%. And that compounds year after year. I mean, the difference between 2% annual inflation and 3%, it may not seem like a lot. It's a ton because it's compounding, right? And you know how compounding interest works. It's massive erosion of purchasing power, you know, keep people's wages. So that theory is like the run it hot type theory. Let's just push a lot of capital on it. Let's use that to grow our economy and hopefully we can grow our way out of this mess. The problem is that will eventually result in a lot of financial repression, I think. That makes it harder for people to bear those constant increases. So you don't have a really good option. So then those are the first two. Then there's the third method. Like, what if we renegotiate everything? What if we try to peg it to something different, whether it be gold or Bitcoin or some alternative asset? That is perhaps a way out, but it's far more violent, yeah. right? And to your point, if you're a wealthy person, right now they have this, you know, CNBC is talking about this debasement trade, where the debasement of the dollar is the path forward, because if you debase the dollar, you make the debt more sustainable. So
it feels like that's what we're trying to do, yeah, but I'm not sure if that. I'll let you finish because
it's exactly it. I mean, look at the price of gold. Look at the price of even the stock market. I think it's such a disconnect because, you know, stocks, okay, they have some implicit inflation protection, right? Because people keep wondering, like, well, how do corporate earnings keep going up with so many people struggling? It's because they can pass along the inflation
to you,
yeah, and you pay for it,
yeah,
right? The biggest challenge, though, out of all of this, if you balance these out, is try to figure out. This is why I always think, like, the problem is political; it's not an actual economic problem. It's that some people at a certain point are going to say enough is enough, and they're going to revolt. Right? Yeah. They could revolt to the left. They can revolt to the right. Either way, I think when you stretch people far enough, that's when you tend to have violent disruption, and then you have someone coming in and saying, "Well, what if we do it this way?" And historically, I think if you look at that. That generally results, if you push people far enough, it generally results in more of a command and control type economy. It generally results in more of a leftist skew. I think historically that's the free market folks don't win that argument. They lose it.
No. Also interesting to this whole idea of the reset, though, and I want you to come back to this, is, okay, prices are depressed. And, you know, those of us who've been wage earners, we are really stuck now.
Yes.
But asset earners are relatively stronger in that role. Do you have a sense of, well, you know what? I'm asking the question I'm going to answer. In 2021, when we went through this process, right, there was a huge shift in ownership that went from wage earners to asset earners because of the depression that took place from COVID.
Right.
So it makes tunnel sense that that's what we are likely to see replicated. I guess the real difference is there any sense that that is something that people are kind of banking on? Like, is the market saying this is going to happen? Whether they're trying to cause it or not is a different question.
Yeah.
But are they so intent now that this is the direction that we're going, that people are now, like Warren Buffett, going into cash, right, waiting for the asset prices to be depressed, you know, buying land up in, you know, New Zealand or wherever it may be to kind of safe haven from this? Is that your sense of what's happening here?
So my view is that if faced between two alternatives, which is deflation and assets falling and inflation, policymakers will always choose inflation. They'll always choose it. And it's a very simple reason, because again, going back to the retirement apparatus, the treasury market, all of these things depend on asset prices rising, tax receipts. I mean, tax receipts alone. Yes. If the stocks fall, tax receipts to the United States government fall, you know, precipitously.
Yes.
So I think they will always favor moving forward hotter inflation than deflation. And part of the thing that is screwing up a lot of investors, I think, is that from the period post-Great Financial Crisis, we had roughly 10 years, right, from 2009 to 2019, where the policymakers at the Federal Reserve would sit around and they can go back and listen to the meetings. They would scratch their head and say, "Is inflation dead? Is there ever going to be inflation again? We can't even generate inflation. We're doing QE, quantitative easing for folks. We're trying to stimulate the economy. We can't generate." And then we get this massive burst of inflation through a variety of factors. Right? It's not any one politician or policy. It's you shut down the global economy.
COVID. Basically.
And at the same time, people were trying to be trying to survive the COVID period. You had a massive influx of spending. We threw huge amounts of cash at the problem. So what is that going to do? It's going to be a cocktail of demand, and you're going to have supply issues because the economy shut down.
We went from famine to feast.
Right. And the problem is that I think that that period was sort of a watershed moment economically, because I think you finally lit the fire of inflation that's going to be, we're going to be fighting against this for a while. Yeah. It doesn't mean like runaway hyperinflation. It just means elevated relative to trend. And in that environment, okay, when you are responding to higher structural inflation, can policymakers, are they going to be willing to pour as much gasoline on the fire with more stimulus in the future? I don't know about that. It's a question, right, for me.
What's interesting, though, in my mind is I think what we saw from COVID, wherever you are kind of on the spectrum of, the level of involvement of government, but for the investments that were made by our government, right, we would be in a much different position.
Absolutely.
We emerged from that process stronger as a nation than every other nation in the world by almost every measure and standard.
Yeah.
And so it kind of cements the concept that, well, there was something to Keynesian economics, and there was something to the importance of the government stimulus. That doesn't mean we got it right, and there's lots of things we can, you know, tinkle with a little bit to kind of make a little bit better. But, you know, monetary policy in that instance was important, but, you know, the fiscal policy won out the day.
I look at it from the standpoint of no matter what path you take in life, in economics, in business, there's always trade-offs, right?
Yeah.
There's no perfect solution when you're dealing with some difficult problem. Like, you know, there's a virus raging. We don't fully understand it. We're trying to figure out how to deal with it. We don't want people to starve. There's breadline. You know, so what are we going to do? We're going to try and figure our way through this, and we might not be right.
Right.
A lot of it's
going to
be.
We're going to do some things that are a little extreme at first, but, you know.
Right. And I think, you know, one of the problems we have as a society is we always cast this sort of negative light of people trying to do something when in reality, I think, you know, there's people that are good and they're trying to figure out their way through a complex world and they're trying to make probabilistic bets with imperfect information.
Yeah.
You know, life, there's a great book, again, young people, I always recommend they read. It's called Thinking in Bets by Annie Duke. And she talks about life isn't chess, right? We don't sit at the board, have perfect information about every piece and every possible move forward and what the result is going to be if we think through it long enough. Life's poker, right? You have incomplete information. You try to figure out your way. You try to make bets. And you can go back.
Learn through the process.
You can learn through the process. And you're never going to play that exact same hand in the exact same way. Every single thing's going to be different. There's going to be a different player across the table. And all you can do is make probabilistic bets. That's it. So, you know, did we do a little bit too much? Maybe. Did we do a little bit, you know, of the wrong type of thing? Maybe. But right now, what are we going to do? That's the key question.
This isn't a sponsored message. It's just what's worked for us. At the Southland Development Authority, we've been using Bill.com for the past 5 years to handle our invoicing and payment processing. For a small but growing organization like ours, it's been a game changer, saving us time, keeping us organized, and making sure payments go out and come in smoothly. It's simple, reliable, and cost-effective. Most importantly, it's freed us up to focus on the work that really matters, serving our community and growing our impact. If you're looking for a better way to handle payments, Bill.com has been the right fit for us.
You're listening to The First Million is Always the Hardest. We are now returning to the show.
You know, it's interesting, and this is a little bit of a sidebar, but, you know, I've had the benefit of working and helping to run a couple of municipalities. And one of the things, when you get to things like COVID, I tell people, is I said, you know, it's easy to criticize the choices that people made, but if you were the person that was responsible for either you're going to wear a mask, you're not going to wear a mask, and X number of more people will die potentially as a result of that decision, you default to a lot of things that might not be where you want to be, but because you don't want to take on the responsibility of having caused injury to someone because you were, you know, you had a view because you're responsible for everybody. It's interesting because I'd like to believe that that's exactly how the fiscal, the world of money is thinking about how they do what is happening with stable coins and bitcoins now. I'm not sure I do. There's a part of me that is a little more worried that the moneyed folks are not worried about what happens to, like, the wage earners.
There's some, but again, there's different groups, right? There are some people that are just saying, I don't care about broader public policy decisions. I want to make money.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people like that. But there are good people out there, I believe, that are trying to make the right call. We talked a little before we jumped on air about the Federal Reserve, the FOMC, and, you know, there are people there who I think, they're, to your point, maybe they're saying we need to err on the side of caution. We need to cut preemptively the rates, even though inflation's way higher than our current target, you know, significantly. We need to cut because we're fearing a slowdown and the economy feels a little wobbly and maybe unemployment's ticking up. So we want to be preemptive in that. And that doesn't mean they're evil or bad actors. It's just they're biased towards, like, let's be cautious here.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of people like that.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, one of the problems is that we don't do as good a job nationally of teaching people fundamentally how these institutions work,
right,
so that they understand what the trade-offs that particular institution is actually making. And to the point, the conversation we had prior to air, you know, my take was, hey, how do I balance the idea that if I make this choice to make a cut today, mm-hmm. I've taken a potential cut away from the future as well.
Yeah, and how do you balance that with the fact that the current chair is done in May?
That's
his
right.
term's up, so it's
That's
like,
right.
let it be the other guy's problem, right?
Yeah, so there's so many elements here. I guess everybody now is going to like Kalshi and all the open markets to figure out what the answer is going to be.
Yeah.
I want to come back to this idea at a practical level. Like, what do people do? So I'm taking care of my parents. I'm got a kid who's in college or more, and I'm trying to figure out how do I play stable coins? How do I play Bitcoins? Yeah. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a real estate developer, a small one, but I want to buy my business. I'm trying to grow my business. What are the practical things in your experience that you think we should be adopting from that perspective?
Well, a lot of it depends on where you're at in life. You know, if you're someone who's built up a great amount of assets, this is why any financial decision is uniquely personal,
yeah.
right? Like you have to figure out like, where am I at? What am I trying to accomplish? And, you know, it helps. I mean, I have an FA myself and I know financial markets really good, but it's good to talk to somebody and have a springboard and say like, okay, here's what I think and check my math on this. Here's what my goals are. Here's what I'm trying to accomplish. I think for younger people, which I spend a lot of time trying to help younger people because I think it's a difficult time right now for a lot of younger people. I always say, you know, to me, the best investment you could make is in yourself yeah. and in your business and in your ability to try to grow income. A lot of younger people, I think, look at it from our financial markets as a big casino. They look at it as sort of like a gambling thing where I have to hit it big, and if I don't hit it big, I'm kind of screwed, to be honest. I think that's exactly the wrong mindset. You should not be trying, even if you win big. I know a ton of guys in crypto that made a lot of money. They became overnight millionaires, and they lost it all within 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
Because they didn't go through the grind of building themselves up, becoming mature. They got cocky. They were too sure of themselves on everything, and it was easy money, easy come, easy go, like with the money, right?
Absolutely.
That story happens again and again because the idea behind true wealth and the first 1 million, right, our show, I think the first 1 million has to come from you when you are ready to go on that path. You have to figure out, am I in a position where I'm going to do what it takes to grow, you know, my personal worth, and not just in a financial sense, but in all respects.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a plug for the show because you're right. You know, one of the things is you can't raise your net worth until you raise your self worth. And
absolutely.
So that concept of, as we were talking earlier, of saying, hey, invest 2 hours a week and get smart about something.
Right.
This is a good opportunity to get smart about, you know, stable coins and Bitcoins. It's a good opportunity to get smart about AI. But that investment for that 2 hours a week over the course of 6 months actually can be completely life-changing.
Well, this is the problem because I think because we live in the era of instant gratification of 10-second TikToks and constant, like, you know, how do we get there quicker? How do I get the answer? That's my biggest fear with AI, right? People not going through the actual work product. People just getting the answer. The most important thing I think to realize about life is that it's complicated, uncertain, and you don't have all the answers.
Yep.
There is no easy answer for a lot of this stuff. So why is that important? It's because if you go through the grind, if you have a low time preference, meaning you're not focused on, you know, what is immediate, how do I get there right away, you're focused on the long haul, that tends to be more rewarding, not just financially, certainly financially, but personally, from a self-worth standpoint,
yep,
knowing that you come from nothing and you built something that's real and you have those deep relationships. And it wasn't just what boxes did I press to get the answer right away. To me, that's critical. And in financial markets, we have people, I think it's so frustrating because I have people that will buy a stock that they'll buy, you know, XYZ company, and then 2 weeks later they'll want to sell it. Like,
what was the purpose of buying it in the first place?
Right, right. And I mean, you have to be focused on the next 10 years, particularly if you're young. You know, some people should be focused on the next 20 or 30 years if they're really young, right?
Yeah.
You shouldn't be focused on what you're doing over the next 6 months because the most important things, the most enriching experiences in life, sometimes they take a decade to get there.
Not sometimes, almost always they take that.
Almost
always. So that's a good transition. And as we kind of start to wind up, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you personally was about how you find personal fulfillment. And you've talked a little bit about the effort that you have underway to work with young people and address some of the issues that are out concerning. But just where does your personal fulfillment come in? How does the work that you're doing right now related to, you know, Bitcoin, stablecoin, digital currencies, all play a role in that.
Yeah. So I get a lot of personal fulfillment from trying to help people. And that starts obviously with my family and close friends, right? But it extends to my clients. I believe firmly we're put on this earth to try to help each other and to try to build communities with one another. I reject really violently the idea of individualism. I think mm-hmm. that like if you're only on the earth to serve yourself and gain personal riches,
yeah.
what's the point?
Yeah.
To me, that's not very fulfilling at all. We were talking about like, you know, younger people getting frustrated. And what I find difficult in this is that I can acknowledge on an intellectual level the silent depression, the
right.
K-shaped economy, how difficult. But when I'm talking to a young person, I'm saying, you got to put all that out of your mind.
Yeah.
You got to get rid of all that. Because I can't tell you how many times I've come up against something where it becomes an excuse. It becomes defeating. It becomes mentally paralyzing. And you have to steel yourself against that. Nothing meaningful ever occurred without a whole host of people saying that will never happen.
Exactly.
You know, and time and time again, I had a case really early on. It was wonderful in my career where all of the managing partners, all the senior partners said, you'll never win that. You're going to go to trial. You're going to get your head buried. You know, it's going to be a mess, right? I went there and I buckled down. I said, I'm going to prove all these guys wrong. And sure enough, we had a fantastic result.
That's great.
It was great. Some stuff like that. And again, that was the fifth time after the four other ones where I lost and it was embarrassing and, you know, a difficult to go look your client in the eyes and say, you know, I'm sorry, we're going to have to pay a huge judgment because
painful.
It's painful. But that one time where I was able to, I think, truly make a difference is worth it. It's worth those four times where it was unsuccessful because there's a lot of people that just get jaded and negative and say, you know what, why do I even bother? And we have a crisis in this country right now about apathy and people saying, why do I even bother? There's no hope for me. I'm stuck. And that's not going to help you.
No. And you know what? It's a lack of perspective. Right. And one of the problems, and this is true for not just young people, but everyone. Like, you know, one of the things I've said last year when I had my team meeting for my organization, I made a statement that I think for a lot of people was controversial, which is, you know, there's never been a time of less poverty in the world than there is today. That's actually a true statement. Now, you don't feel that way, but the fact that you don't feel that way doesn't mean that their feelings are true.
Right.
Right. But if you were to evaluate poverty as, you know, around the world over the course of world's history, we have less today than we've ever had before. But you have to look at it at that kind of scale. If you're looking at it just in the last 10 years, that might not be true. If you're looking at it in the last five, it's definitely not true.
So why, Bo, in a situation like that where we have less poverty, we have a lot of opportunities, everybody's got Netflix and phones and everything, why do we have surging rates of depression, suicide, opioid addictions, all this sort of, you know, people that are dissatisfied and very frustrated with this existence? And that's the most fascinating question.
It is. And I think you actually hit on it earlier, which is it's about social connection. And it's that this concept, it's a very Western concept about individualism and what individualism means. Because in Western concept, the idea of individualism is devoid of any social and broader responsibility. And I don't believe that that's true. I believe there is even as an individual, you have a social responsibility to others, whether you know them or not. And I think the breakdown of those social constructs that come in all different types of forms, whether it be from communities and how people grew up and live, and whether people are in, you know, other spiritual communities, or whether people, you know, just literally sit and talk to one another, you know, simple things like I get on the airplane, I sit next to a person on the airplane, I talk to that person, all those little things,
yeah.
They all play a role. Like there's a reason that solitary confinement is considered a cruel and harsh penalty for a reason, right? And it's and people forget that we are social beings by design.
Right.
By design. And so the breakdown of that social construct actually has all different types of things that affect us. And one of them is our inability to have perspective, right? Those ancient stories that are told from your grandmother and your great-grandmother and all this stuff, they get lost and you're not told. So you don't have perspective of what's happened over the course of time.
Yes.
Doesn't mean that you should be, you know, you'd be placated by where we are today. It's just to acknowledge that things can be bad today and still be better than they were before.
Absolutely.
Right? Those two things are not at wit's end to one another. So I want to take and ask you just a few lightning questions
sure. yeah.
before we end. And want to thank you again for just a really intellectually engaging conversation. So here are my three questions. I had to write these down, right? So in 2035, which matters more, spot Bitcoin ETFs or dollar stablecoins?
So the spot Bitcoin ETFs are going to be really important. I think Bitcoin in general is the more important than the stablecoins in 2035.
But all right. Question number two is central bank digital currency, yes, no, or already obsolete?
So I say no central bank digital currency in the next 10 years, and here's why. Number one, to get the Fed's policy, the Federal Reserve, and Chair Powell has talked about this already, they believe through their legal memorandums that you can't issue a central bank digital currency without an act of Congress. Now, I think a act of Congress that empowers the Fed to issue a central bank digital currency is going to take
a big deal.
It's going to take a ton of resistance. And number one, one of the most powerful lobbies in the United States, the banking lobby, is going to fight tooth and nail to kill it. Because what does it do? It would allow the Fed to directly issue a tokenized asset to U.S. consumers. I think that's going to be very difficult because they're going to cut out the banks, right? If there truly is a U.S. CBDC, a U.S. central bank, what is the purpose of the banking institution but for extending lines of credit, right? They're not going to like that. So I think they're going to have a lot of bank lobbies do whatever it takes to restrict that. The only exception that would change my thinking is if there was a true catastrophe, if there was a true need to get money into the hands of, you know, tens of millions of people. You know, like Rahm Emanuel said, there's never let a crisis go to waste.
That's
like
right.
That would be a situation where you could probably get it through in that situation. But short of that, which I don't expect that, I expect actually more of the silent depression over the next 10 years. A lot of more of the wealth divide, income inequality divide. That's sort of my base case. So no, I don't think you're getting it.
All right. And the last one here is, would you rather own tokenized treasury, a bank stablecoin, or physical gold for the next 5 years?
Not the tokenized treasury. Certainly not a stablecoin, because you're not going to get any return on that. So gold.
You're stuck with gold.
Gold's the only, by default.
You've gone back to the 1970s.
I got to have gold if I want return on the investment. I think gold's going to do fine. I mean, it's not going to do what I think Bitcoin's going to do, but.
Can gold really go that much higher?
I mean, you're talking relative, right? So, like, I hold zero gold. Okay,
all
so
right.
So I'm not a gold investor. I'd rather own Nvidia stock than gold, which I do. Among those choices, I'm going to go with gold.
All right. Yeah. Well, this is good. Well, listen, this was fantastic.
Yeah.
And your breadth of knowledge and your application in the space is fantastic. And thank you for coming on the show.
It's
really appreciate it.
All right. Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
Thank you.
Man. Appreciate it.